And I don't think it's any coincidence that there's a lot of beans up here.
Yes.
Some people say the council is full of them. I think we're going to go ahead and get started. The city council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman. Potter.
Here. Before we begin the official proceedings of council, I have a proclamation to read, and the proclamation is in support of the United States Census Bureau. As everybody knows, in 2010, we're going to have probably the most full and complete census of people in our country that's ever been done. And so to that end, I'd like to invite up Mr. Richard Lightfoot, and I'd like to read the following proclamation. Whereas an accurate census count is vital to our community, go ahead and please sit down, Mr. Lightfoot, to our community and residents' well-being by helping planners determine where to locate schools, daycare centers, roads, and public transportation, hospitals, and other facilities, and is used to make decisions concerning business growth and housing needs. Whereas more than $300 billion per year in federal and state funding is allocated to states and communities based on census data, and census data ensures fair congressional representation by determining how many seats each state will have in the U.S. House of Representatives, as well as the redistricting of state legislatures, county and city councils, and voting districts. And whereas the 2010 census creates jobs that stimulate economic growth and create employment opportunities in our community, whereas Mayor-elect Sam Adams has pledged to carry this partnership forward into his term of office beginning January 2009, the information collected by the Census Bureau is protected by law and remains confidential for 72 years. Now, therefore, I, Tom Potter, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim this day, December 3, 2008, that the City of Portland is committed to partnering with the U.S. Census Bureau to help ensure a full and accurate count in 2010. And with us today is Mr. Richard Lightfoot. Please say a few words, sir.
Well, thank you, Mayor Potter and council members. You've already hit upon, you know, what the census is going to do, but you know, in the very short term, we're going to be hiring about 100 people, or about 1,000 people in the next month and a half to work here in this city. And the number they need to call if they would like to be considered for a job is 1-866-861-2010. Once they call that number, they will be provided a test site where they can go take the test for the census, and then we'll pull up the test data. Our goal is to hire people from the local area to do the census in their local area. And so we're looking at hiring about, 1,000 people. And the pay scale ranges everywhere from $15.25 an hour to $18.75 an hour. So it's not bad pay for the temporary jobs.
I think that's a great incentive. And as you told me earlier, you'd really like to see also more people of color as part of this process. Because it's really going to impact a lot of our communities that have been traditionally underreported. So I really want to thank you for that, Mr. Lightfoot. And the Portland City Council certainly appreciates what you and your organization are doing.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And the phone number is on the screen there for folks to call. If you know someone who could use a temporary job, but a very rewarding one and one that will help our community, please have them call this number. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
City Council will come to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams.
Here.
Fish.
Here.
Leonard.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Potter.
Here. Read the 2 p.m. time certain.
Item 1674, Oregon Food Bank presentation.
Thank you. We're really pleased to have representatives from the Oregon Food Bank. Could you folks come on up with us today? Phil Calver is the chairman of the Oregon Food Bank Board of Directors, and Rachel Bristol is the executive director of the Oregon Food Bank. We've asked Phil and Rachel for an update regarding how the Oregon Food Bank fared over Thanksgiving and how they are positioning for the upcoming holiday season and the longer term. We all read the newspapers or watch the news every day and are well aware that the country is in the midst of an economic crisis. Organizations like the Oregon Food Bank are critically important anytime. But during times like these, we realize how much our community depends upon the services they offer. Now more than ever, the Oregon Food Bank and the organizations it support may be the only way for some folks to put a meal on the table for their family. Phil and Rachel, thank you for joining us today, and thank you for what the Oregon Food Bank does.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Commission. And I want to thank you on behalf of the Oregon Food Bank Board for all that you've done in the past in terms of the hunger issue and what you're doing today, and hopefully what happens in the future. I got involved with the Oregon Food Bank a few years ago when we had the dubious distinction of being one of the most hungry and the most food insecure states in the country. And steps were taken by Rachel and the staff out at Oregon Food Bank to address this issue in terms of getting more people on food stamps, increasing the supply and the delivery of food. And we started making progress. Then a couple years ago, another bomb hit us, and that was a declining or a stable food supply when there was an increasing need. In fact, we lost USDA appropriations. They were way down. We lost many of the local food suppliers because they're A, either being bought out, or B, becoming more efficient and didn't have the seconds and the like. So we started programs to address this, the Fresh Alliance program with grocery stores, encouraging organizations and working with organizations like Farmers Ending Hunger, the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and the like. And we started to make progress on the food supply side. But as you all know, we've been hit with another bomb, and that's the increased demand for emergency food supplies, which has just been astronomical the last few months, anywhere from 12 to, I think, up to 40% across the state. And I think you all know also the interrelationship between hunger and many of the other issues that we face in our society. Obviously, if people are hungry, they aren't that attentive at school. If people buy food and can't pay for the rent, they have to find another place to live, which again has effects on schools. And obviously, this is all interrelated with homelessness and also with our health care system. So there is a real need out there. And fortunately, we have an organization like the Oregon Food Bank that is doing a lot to address this need. And I'm going to introduce Rachel Bristol. I'm sure you probably all know her, but she basically is not only our executive director, not only our leader, but she is the heart and soul of what happens in this state in terms of addressing the issue of hunger. Rachel came to the state in 1983, I believe it was, as a VISTA volunteer, working with the Oregon Food Share. And then as that basically joined with the Oregon Food Share and the Portland Interagency Food Share, it formed the Oregon Food Bank. And Rachel became our executive director in 1990. And she has been our executive director and CEO since then. The organization is kind of a different than you'll see anywhere else across the country. It's basically a state that has an interrelationship in the delivery system of food to the hungry. We operate, or we basically distribute food to over 16 other regional food agencies, four of which we run ourselves, and the other ones totally independent of us. And there are over 900 local agencies to which this food is given to be distributed throughout the state. And it's with Rachel's leadership that this is being done. So I'd like to, at this time, introduce Rachel and again thank her for all that she has done for the issue of hunger in Oregon. Rachel.
Thanks, Phil. Mayor Potter and commissioners, thank you again for inviting us here today to speak about the hunger crisis here in Portland. As Phil shared with you, For the last 3 years, we've been facing declining food supplies, and last year a very dramatic food shortage. This year, the food supply is climbing a little bit, but it's being far outstripped by the rise in demand. Starting about a year ago this time, we started seeing significant increases throughout the state, primarily in the more rural areas of the state along the coast. And Portland remained pretty flat during 2007-2008. So that was the good news. The supply was keeping up with the need here in Portland. That changed dramatically in the first quarter of the current fiscal year. Here in Portland, we saw a 12% increase in the request for emergency food just in the first quarter. And since that time, it's been growing even more rapidly. In October, we're still getting the data in, but 48 out of the 56 emergency food pantries in our network reported that they saw an increase of 41% of them reported increases of 40% or more. I always do better when I just talk and I don't have to try to remember to say things. Let me give you a couple examples. Fish Emergency Services, which I know you're very familiar with, reported a 57% increase. Crossroads Cupboard, 35%. Ecumenical Ministries Northeast Emergency Food Program jumped 23%. Good Samaritan Center in North Portland, 85% increase in the request for emergency food. The list goes on, and in the written testimony, you have many other examples, increases up 72%. It's throughout the Portland area. One of the toughest jobs at Oregon Food Bank right now is that of our receptionist, Maren Kausch. I invited her, actually, to join me today to testify, and she declined. However, she did take the time to write up for you some of the stories of, you know, who are the folks that are turning to us in need. We've been hearing from our agencies that 30 to 50% of the people who are showing up are coming for the first time in their lives. And Maren's stories really confirm that. I'll read to you a few examples that she provided. The most common story I hear is people that have been laid off. Usually it's the husband who's been laid off for the past few months, and now the wife has gotten laid off. They've run out of money. They're in need of food. Unemployment checks are being cut back. They barely make ends meet. They've already applied for food stamps, but there's 2 weeks wait for an appointment. Recently, I've had a number of calls from realtors, and again, we hear this from our member agencies, realtors, title company, construction workers, a whole new group of people who've never had to turn to our system before. The drop in the housing market has affected lives, Maren says. Often it's a single mother who tries to provide a good life for her children, but finds herself in a bad situation with her commissions and income dropping drastically. They've already downsized their normal everyday spending, and they find themselves in need of food to survive. Mothers with newborns are calling for infant formula. We can only hope that the emergency food box agencies that we referred them to have some to give them. The disabled and the elderly, a significant increase among that population. Many of them don't have any transportation. They've got mobility issues. And without exception, they feel very bad to have to call and ask. And repeatedly, they will tell Maren, I've always been able to take care of myself. I never imagined I would be calling the food bank. Unfortunately, only a few of our local agencies are able to deliver food boxes. And those that do have to limit distribution to once every 3 months because of the limits of the food supply. More people are walking in firsthand. And to give you the more recent, view, this time of year, numbers go up. Often it's requests for holiday baskets as agencies year to year try to go above and beyond to provide an extra help for the holidays. This year, that's not why they're calling. Instead of an average of 100 to 120 calls a month, last Monday, Marin received 100 calls in the first hour of the workday. 100 calls. And what Marin's stories don't show, what you can't see from the words on the paper, is the emotion that each of those calls contains. Here's Marin sitting at the reception desk. There's mobs of volunteers arriving to help us repack food. That's terrific. And there's Marin saying, it's okay to cry. It's okay, take your time. It's okay to cry. From so many people who don't know where else to turn, they have no idea, really, that there is a broad network there that's trying to catch them. At this time, more than ever, we need all the help we can get. So, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what you can do. And I will say that this community has been very responsive. We frankly are overwhelmed with calls from businesses, individuals wanting to do food drives for us. At this point, what we really need are volunteers to pick up and deliver barrels for all of those folks that are wanting to do food drives. Food drives, frankly, can be kind of an expensive way of raising food. So what we are encouraging is, for individual contributions, of course, you can always drop them off at our site, but we can also refer you to direct to a food pantry. Drop them off in your neighborhood at an agency that can help. Drop your donations there. Or throughout the month of December, you can drop your food donations at any U.S. Bank branch or any Jiffy Lube. That will really help us streamline the process and bring in lots of very good quality food. And again, if you organize your own food drive, we'd ask that you help us out by delivering it either to the food bank or a member agency. Keep in mind that we're having difficulty keeping enough trucks and drivers on the road to keep that food moving. Cash contributions are especially important right now. We are in the process of trying to raise $1 million to purchase additional food to supplement what's being donated by the food industry and the U.S. government. Financial support also pays for packaging supplies. We have 27,000 volunteers that, and I'm sure you've been there. I know I've seen some of you packing food in our warehouse. We buy in bulk, and much of the food that's donated comes in bulk, and we pack that up so it's in a form that our agencies and their clients can serve them. Transportation costs are going up as you all know, particularly as we're trying to move more food. And I will tell you that while our volume was up 12% overall in the first quarter, it is still moving out faster than it's coming in. And we have a lot of empty racks in that warehouse. Folks can also donate online. Go to our website, www.oregonfoodbank.org. There you'll see lots of ways that you can contribute anything that people can do to help. I would also call on the City Council to continue your efforts to create more family wage jobs. I know that is a priority for you, and that's the real solution to the hunger crisis in Portland and throughout our state. Folks, please find the nearest food pantry next to you. They also need volunteers. Most of these are small agencies. They're being supported by churches and other organizations of faith, and they don't have enough help to lug those boxes and help people in and out the door with food. We are totally booked for our volunteer shifts through December, so I would ask you to remember that the need will still be there after the first of the year. Folks can call us up and sign up for shifts January, February, and March. I am most worried about what's going to happen after the holidays. You know, during the holidays, most people everywhere are thinking about their neighbors in need. But after the first of the year, people's lives get busy and they don't think so much about that, and donations tend to drop dramatically. We know the need is not going to drop dramatically come January 1st. And so we ask you to continue to do everything you can to help us. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Fish, did you wish to make a statement?
Thank you, Mayor. First, I want to express our thanks to Rachel and to Phil for your powerful presentation. You've given us an alarming picture of hunger in Oregon, as well as a call to action. During these tough times, we hear a lot about banks and bailouts, and these are all very serious things. But for the more than 50,000 Oregonians, these tough times means that they will go to bed tonight hungry, tonight and every night. We know that hunger impacts us all, and these people may be our neighbors, our family members, or our coworkers. On Thanksgiving Day, my daughter Maria and I volunteered for Loaves and Fishes. We delivered meals to elderly shut-ins in North Portland. It was the only meal that many of the people we served would have that day. And they were incredibly grateful for the food and for the limited and brief companionship that we gave them. But in the richest and most powerful nation in the world, this is shameful. I often say that a home without a job is an empty promise. And today I'll add that a home without food is an empty future. Children who are hungry have trouble learning in school, and hunger produces stress that impacts a family's ability to lead healthy lives. Last month, as you indicated, the United States Department of Agriculture ranked Oregon third as the state with the highest percentage of hunger. What a dubious statistic. And as you noted, Rachel, this past quarter, the Oregon Food Bank reported a 13% increase in emergency food box requests. Now, your food supplies are low, and this, together with the economic calamity we're going through, means that individuals' ability to donate funds directly is strained.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while this news can be disheartening, I think we all understand that there's a great opportunity before us. And our president-elect has issued a challenge to all Americans. And I'm actually fond of reading these words because I've waited 8 years to be able to quote my president on any subject. He said on his election night, "Let us summon a new spirit of patriotism, of service and responsibility, where each of us resolves to pitch in and work harder and look after not only ourselves but each other. Let us remember that if this financial crisis taught us anything, it's that we cannot have a thriving Wall Street while Main Street suffers. In this country, we rise or fall as one nation, as one people." So it is in the spirit of community service that we come together as a community, and we all step up to do our part to end hunger. Today, Mayor Potter and the members of this council issue a challenge to our community to take this issue to the next level. And you've identified things and given us a roadmap for how we can help. We can donate food, and that includes filling a bag and dropping it off at any Jiffy Lube or U.S. Bank. We can donate funds, and you've made it as easy as possible because we can go online at www.oregonfoodbank.org. We can donate time by volunteering, and as you've indicated, you're filled up in December, but in January, February, March, the need is just as urgent. And we can advocate. We can take time to learn about the issues and advocate for public policies that reduce the underlying causes of hunger. Perhaps we can even end poverty in our lifetime, which, after all, is the root cause. So So again, I would like to join with my colleagues in thanking you, Rachel, for your work, and you, Phil, and Gene Kempware, and the Oregon Food Bank for the tremendous work that you do. Your work directly impacts the quality of people's lives and health every day. And I would close by letting you know that this City Council looks forward to working with you in the months and years ahead to continue to raise awareness and to end hunger in our community. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any other statements from commissioners?
No, thanks for all the good work that you do. I've had the opportunity to spend a couple hours on a good tour, and the work you do is just amazing and needed now more than ever. Thank you.
You know, I'm really proud to be mayor of a city where our community comes together in difficult times, and I know that this is a difficult time for many families, and I appreciate the fact that folks are going to be stepping up and helping out. And I don't know if you've mentioned the website, but certainly the OregonFoodBank.org is a good place to go to figure out where to send the money or the non-perishable goods. You can also look at Portland Online. .com, which is the city's website, because we have a direct link to the Oregon Food Bank on our website. So there's a lot of ways that folks can get in touch, but the important thing is to get in touch and make a difference. So thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Phil. And did we have a food bin here to put our cans of food into? There it is. Okay, would the commissioners join me in putting the food in our...
Thank you for remembering the fruit, Mayor-elect Adams. Canned and packaged fruit is especially important this time of year.
I love the fruit.
Are we done?
Let's see how they do.
I see you read the most wanted foods list. Very good. Most wanted foods, peanut butter, tuna fish, hearty soups, stews, things that are easy to make a meal out of. We get lots of bread donated, so sandwich fixings types of things are good. Another thing that's not on our list but we need to add to it is cooking oil. Cooking oil has gotten very expensive, and we're having to buy cooking oil. It's just not something that's donated. And so that's something in particular agencies are saying they're spending a lot of money on. Powdered milk is also another good item. Infant formula, dry infant formula within co-date. Is also extremely important for the moms out there. Thank you. We appreciate
your
support.
Thank you for coming in, folks.
Yep.
Carla, could you please read the 2:30 time certain, and could you read all five ordinances together?
Yes. 1675, amend and extend term of right-of-way agreement granted to AT&T Wireless Services of Oregon, Inc. to build and operate wireless facilities within the city streets. 1676, amend and extend term of a temporary revocable permit granted to LCW Wireless Operations, LLC, to build and operate wireless facilities within the city streets. 1677, amend and extend term of a temporary revocable permit to Clearwire US LLC to use the city streets to provide wireless broadband internet access services and establish terms and conditions. 1678, amend and extend term of a right-of-way agreement granted to Sprint Spectrum LP to build and operate wireless facilities within the city streets. 1679, amend and extend term of a right-of-way agreement granted to VoiceStream PCSI LLC, now known as T-Mobile West Corporation, to build and operate wireless facilities within the city streets.
Mr. Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. I'm pleased to present these proposed wireless amendments today that are contained in these franchise agreement renewals. They're the result of almost a year of extensive public outreach with citizens and industry. And it's important to understand that these amendments what they are and what they are not. They are not about permitting new cell towers. They are about instituting additional stringent conditions that must be met when placing or replacing antenna facilities on existing or replacement utility poles in the right-of-way. In addition to working with citizens and industry, staff worked extensively with other city bureaus, including transportation, Bureau of Development Services, planning, parks, and the city attorney's office. So I'm happy to see that, we have some public here today who will testify because they've been instrumental in crafting these requirements. And as we've heard more feedback since the announcement of this item at council, I would also like to propose an amendment today that will include neighborhood business associations along with neighborhood associations as organizations that wireless providers must meet with, and Carla's distributing that amendment right now. So as I said, the current language requires wireless providers to meet with neighborhood associations. This amendment would also include neighborhood business associations. And I'd like to now turn it over to cable staff, Mary Beth Henry, the deputy director, and David Solos, the program manager, to walk through the process and the substance of these new requirements in more detail.
Thank you, Commissioner Saltzman. Good afternoon, Mayor and commissioners. I'm Mary Beth Henry. And as Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, we're here today to present proposed wireless amendments that strive to accommodate the increasing demand for wireless technology in residential areas while protecting neighborhood livability within the legal environment in which the city must work. We are here today because there are over 450,000 wireless phones, like this one, being used in Portland, many of them in residential areas. We've been working with citizens, industry representatives, and other city staff for over a year. And I'd like to take a moment to thank the citizens who came to our public meetings with some excellent suggestions on how to improve this process, especially the neighbors who live near North Wilbur and Deakum, who thoughtfully described what was needed to improve the city's process. I'd also like to thank the industry representatives who helped us to better understand the intricacies of wireless technology, as well as city staff who helped to craft new approval criteria. These improved procedures include requiring carriers to provide notice to neighbors of what they'd like to do, and the procedures require the carriers to hold a public meeting with the neighborhood association before applying to install new facilities in the right-of-way in residential areas. The city staff who deserve special mention include, first and foremost, Ben Walters of the City Attorney's Office and Amy True of Commissioner Saltzman's office. From PDOT, we worked with Christine Leone, Alex Bejarano, and John May. From Development Services, Sylvia Kate. From Planning, Phil Namony. From Parks, Rob Crouch and Dave McAllister. During this process, staff's consistent goal has been to provide a better balance between protecting the character of Portland's neighborhoods with the need to accommodate the seemingly relentless demand for wireless service in those same neighborhoods. Wireless is becoming essentially a lifeline utility service and the only voice communication for many Portlanders. Simultaneously, Portlanders are using wireless technology for more and more purposes. They're surfing the internet, they're downloading videos, they're doing email. This results in an increased demand for bandwidth capacity to meet these new uses of wireless technology. While protecting neighborhood livability, the city is also obliged to accommodate increasing demand for wireless services consistent with the federal and state imposed legal constraints. Staff has prepared a PowerPoint presentation for you. We think it's important, particularly with this issue, to show you what we're talking about with pictures of poles and wireless antenna in residential neighborhoods. We'll go into detail about why this is happening, what's driving the demand, how the citizens really informed the process, and how these proposed amendments will give citizens a voice and some assurances regarding these poles and antennae that they do not have today. I think it's important to note that the city policy normally recommends 10-year terms for right-of-way agreements. In this case, however, we are recommending a much shorter term of 3 years. This is because the technology is constantly changing and demand is rising so rapidly. The shorter term will allow staff to revisit the agreements, evaluate how the process is working in conjunction with our citizens, and propose any necessary adjustments in fairly short order. Now, Dave Solis would like to do the presentation.
But if I could, just so that I'm clear as I look at the visuals, what has changed, the new assurances or the new, what's different since this was last at council in October is the requirement that they have a meeting with the Neighborhood Association and Business Association. Is that right?
That's part of it, but there's more than that as well. That is kind of at the end of my presentation.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm David Solis, Program Manager in the Office of Cable and Franchise Management. To reiterate, I want to be really clear about what we are not talking about, because there seems to be an unending source of confusion. We are not talking about cell towers. We're not talking about cell towers in streets. The first slide is of a cell tower in the background. This is in a commercial area near Milwaukee and Powell. This is not what we're talking about. There will be no new towers in the right-of-way. There's a zero net gain policy, which means if they replace a pole with a taller one for an antenna, they have to take the old pole out. What you see here is a cell tower. It's major differences from a utility pole. It's galvanized steel. It's probably 80 to 100 feet tall. It has three carriers on it, and it's on private property. At the base, you can't see it. There's probably a 10 by 10 chain link fence with barbed wire on top with a cabinet, equipment cabinet there. None of this is going to be allowed in the right-of-way.
So when you say it's not about cell phone towers,
correct,
you mean that it's not about adding cell phone towers?
It's not about cell towers. It's about placing antenna on utility poles. So when you look at that cell tower, you can see the panel and all that entire structure. The only reason it's there is to elevate the antenna. So all we're talking about is putting the antenna, when feasible, on a utility pole, and that's what the next slide demonstrates. This is on West Burnside. These are antenna that have been in place for probably 10 or 12 years. The pole wasn't replaced. They were placed below the power lines, and they were painted brown to somewhat blend in with the surroundings. This, in our opinion, is a fairly ideal use of a utility pole and supports the council's policy of co-location, which is to use any and every structure that's already in there before a new cell tower is built.
And David, if I might interrupt, this is Ben Walters with the City Attorney's Office. These particular type of antenna are for the purposes of providing services to cars passing by. This is a heavily traveled area of Burnside and in a gully. And so these are the kinds of antenna that are put up to provide services to people passing through. These are not the kind of neighborhood antennas that we'll be getting to in just a little bit.
So I must be the only one up here who asked this question, but when you say that this is not about cell phone towers, I'm not sure I understand. What is this?
This policy that is before you today, the amendments that are being proposed are to the city's policy on co-location of cell phone facilities on utility poles. What we're talking about here are utility poles in the right-of-way and attachments to those poles by the cell phone companies, attachments that are otherwise allowed for under federal and state law. And so what this policy is about is implementing that local, at a local level, that state and federal authority that the cell phone companies have to use utility facilities, and finding a way to accommodate that's federal and state policy in a way that addresses neighborhood concerns.
So this is not about cell phone towers that are cell phone equipment that is on towers apart from what I call telephone poles.
Right. This is not about attachments to, say, water towers. It's not the standalone towers that you might see.
So when this issue came up
on private property,
when this issue came up in October, and we saw the picture of the
Arbor Lodge,
I thought that was a new tower. Is that
We'll be getting to that just shortly.
This section is only about co-location.
Well, there was a confusion about that because of the way it was put up and the way it looked when it was originally installed. That particular incident served to inform the later development of policy, which is what David's going to describe in just a little bit.
I await.
Okay. So this is, again, an antenna placement on an existing pole. Under our current policy, they can also replace poles with ones that are 20 or 30 feet taller and place antenna on them. And this is a pole at 39th and Burnside that reflects that. It is a replacement pole. It's a wooden pole. It's 10 or 15 feet taller than the original one, and there's a canister antenna at the top. When I showed this to some of my friends, they couldn't even tell there was a canister on top. This is much more, this in the previous slide, and that antenna is much more what our policy is geared to.
So that I'm clear, while we may not be talking about erecting new towers, we might be talking about extending the height of existing telephone poles.
Correct. And our current policy allows that, and there's no criterion in there for the choice of a pole. It's between the carrier and the power company. Our amendments actually do address that, and we go into a hierarchy of non-residential streets and non-residential land designations before, but I'll get to that in a minute. So again, couple of quick slides about why we're here. I think we all know about the exponential growth and adoption of wireless services. Here you can see about 250 Americans have cell phones.
So it's based on these trends, how many more, I don't know whether to, I guess two-part, how many more cell phone co-located facilities are we expected to require in the city based on trends, and how many standalone cell phone facilities would we expect to see in our city?
It's difficult for me to answer that because that's primarily a question for Bureau of Development Services. There's about 800 antenna in the city, and there's only about 50 of those that are in the right-of-way at all. So a lot of what we've done, we've designed to kind of follow the zoning code so we have similar development and protections.
So what you're saying, it's Commissioner Leonard's fault. Thank you.
I would never say that. Okay. So the Oregon experience is demonstrated here. The primary point of this is that today there are about twice as many active cell phones in Oregon as there are Qwest lines or basic residential and business phone lines. And as you can see from the trajectory of those lines, and that they end in 2006, that gap is, I'm sure, greater today than it was 2 years ago. So what does this mean for Portland? Well, as Mary Beth pointed out, about 85% of residents have a phone or that equivalent, and that's about 450,000 active cell phones in Portland. And this is, again, an old number from early 2007, so I'm sure it's more than that now. And wireless has also become a lifeline service, which is also a reason we need to keep the service excellent in residential areas. These statistics come from federal surveys. About 70,000 Portlanders, based on that, only have a cell phone. They do not have any Qwest service. So if they have 911 issues, they only have their cell phone from which to call. And about 30% of the population is primarily wireless, even if they do have a landline. And has been true for some time, well more than half of our 911 calls do come from wireless phones. So with a three-year experience with these companies, we have work with planning and development services, we began thinking about amendments to this actually about in 2004 when the zoning code changed, and it made it a lot harder to build cell towers, and it made it easier to place cabinets when the antenna are on utility poles. So we began this public process for these amendments in about 2006, And in March, we had three public meetings. Then we had a very large online survey that covered a couple of months. And we had an extraordinary response to that. Developed another iteration, had a final public meeting in October. However, before this happened, we had the Wilbur and Deakum situation, which I have a little history of, and I'm sure we're at all somewhat familiar with. This is the original electrical distribution pole at Wilbur and Deakum. It's 34 feet tall, which is the average height of any distribution pole in a residential area in Portland. That pole was replaced a little less than a year ago, I think, and this is what it was replaced with, and this is the photo that you were referring to earlier, that it does look, for all intents and purposes, like a cell tower, even though it's not. It's in the right-of-way. It's not new. You can see in this one the shadow of the old pole that was removed.
What do you mean it's not new?
It's what we call a replacement pole. It's not an added pole in the right-of-way. So, yes, technicalities.
And was there an explanation as to why they went from wood poles to metal?
We do not regulate the material that these are made of.
Can we?
Pardon?
Can we?
Well, the one other piece that we did, we actually inquired about that a couple of ways in our survey, and the basic survey response was either replace a wood pole with one that looks like it, but it doesn't have to be wood. So we didn't. We opted not to.
The
choice of materials is determined in the negotiations between the utility and the cell phone provider. It's a determination by the structural engineers having to do with what's going to be put up on the pole and what else is going to be attached to the pole. I'll get to your question in just a second. We could regulate that, but it would mean undertaking to do determinations on structural engineering. And the other part of it is that these types of poles, these wooden poles, are getting more and more expensive. And there are environmental aspects to putting wooden poles in the right-of-way, and that is that they are creosote impregnated, and creosote is an environmentally hazardous material. And so, to a certain extent, using metal is more environmentally friendly.
My question wasn't necessarily, and I didn't mean to suggest, can we require wood poles? My question was, can we regulate the material that the pole is constructed of, understanding you'd want to take all of that into consideration?
We could regulate it, and in fact, we do to a certain extent in terms of the visual aspects of the pole, and that. That aspect of this policy was informed by what happened out at Arbor Lodge, where it was replaced with an unpainted pole, and there were aesthetic concerns that were raised, and the policy now addresses that by requiring that the replacement pole be painted with something that is similar to the visual look of the pole that it is replacing.
But that also implies then we could regulate the material that the pole's made of as well then.
We could.
If we wanted to.
It would require more administrative resources.
Right.
And just so that Commissioner Linder was talking about material, you spoke a little bit to my question in terms of design. The difference between that pole cap that you showed versus the things at the top of this cell tower are not insignificant. Can we regulate? I assume those are two different technologies or something?
We do regulate it now. The current regulations do not regulate the antenna. And again, the current ones didn't because the zoning code doesn't. So when antenna are placed on private property, there's not a specific regulation for the antenna. There's regulation of the structure that raises it, of the mounting device, but not of the antenna itself.
But could there be?
That's my question.
That's a private property development services question.
Well, but we regulate the pitch of roofs. We regulate a lot of things that happen on private property. Why couldn't we regulate the antenna?
That could be regulated, but that would be a discussion outside of this because that would be an amendment to the zoning code.
But the pole you were referenced earlier, that you showed earlier, where it was a wooden pole, regardless of the material, and there was a cone at top that you yourself said, and I agreed, that it is less obvious a cell phone tower versus what you just showed, to me those were significant differences.
Than a panel antenna.
Okay, and you're correct. Saying that we can or cannot regulate those kinds of different looks.
May I?
Go ahead.
We are now addressing that in advance of the zoning code in our amendments. The zoning code currently doesn't.
Those appear to be, so I'm being educated here, those appeared to both be in the right-of-way.
Correct.
So why are you talking about a zoning code applying to private property, or what am I missing?
The point that David was making before was that the existing policy was informed by the zoning code. The zoning code does not contain requirements addressing the types of antennas that are put up on the pole. And in response to the neighborhood concerns that were raised regarding this particular installation, the policy was modified. The policy that's being proposed today was modified to address not only the appearance of the pole and that it be painted before installation, but also the appearance of the antenna, the attached facilities going onto the utility pole.
Can we, so if I could just follow, so just to be clear, this is right, I'm talking about right-of-way poles, that we can regulate these, we could mandate, for instance, the cone antenna versus this other antenna that we saw on the screen last?
That's what we're trying to get at with this new policy. And if
but the new policy applies just to right-of-way.
Right.
Yes.
So I think the questions from here are right-of-way and private property. And you're saying that we'd have to do the zoning code.
You'd have to do a zoning code amendment to address the private property concerns.
And we can't, so we don't have the authority through Office of Cable and Franchise to regulate the installation of cell phone antennae on private property currently?
That's correct. We don't have jurisdiction over private property. That's with Development Services and the Planning Bureau.
David, could we go back to the picture before and after for a second?
Can I ask we go through the presentation first? Because I think we're going to forget a lot of the stuff that goes with the flow of this presentation. Can we at least get through to the policy and the recommendations and then have questions, I would ask?
Well, the only concern I have is that there's more to this story than just painting the pole. And I just want to make sure that when we look at that picture, people understand what actually changed. That's the only comment I want to add to the record, and then I will be happy to wait till the end. But I don't want to have to come back to that slide if I can just set it up.
I think we're there. On my PowerPoint, I'm still at the Wilburn Deacom original replacement pole.
If you could just go back to the former pole for a second, and the former
wood the original?
Pole, the original. And
can you see
the,
this on your screens?
Yeah, so that's the original. Now,
correct.
Where is the cell phone component to that pole?
On this original?
Yes.
There wasn't. That's why it was replaced.
All right, and I just want to be clear. I live in Grant Park. We have a lot of these wooden poles that have a light attached to them and carry electrical or phone lines, but they don't have any cell phone component to them. So go to the next picture for a second. Okay. So this is what appeared in front of this individual's house. This is not anything like what was there before, and it has this unit at the top, and I'm not even going to try to describe what that is, but it allows for some cell phone coverage. And at the base of this pole, there's a square utility door that you open, and buried in that is something I think is called a transponder. Help me out with that, David. What's that called?
There's a vault in the right-of-way, and it's actually to the left. The pole. The right-of-way is very, very wide, the undeveloped right-of-way, and there's a vault
and what's
that,
the
has the, that has the equipment, and there's also cooling equipment in that vault.
And I just want people to understand what the issue that we raised before, because it sounds like you're addressing it, but I just want to make sure it's set up. So there was a wooden pole that was just like any other residential wooden pole carrying electrical lines with a light that's replaced now with a metal pole that has a cell phone apparatus on the top, has this additional equipment that's buried next to it to the left, which a number of the neighbors complained caused some radio frequency disruption in their house and some noise. We can argue that, but that's what you and I heard when we were at the community meeting. And the other piece of this was that the folks on this street had received a notice from PGE saying there'd be a brief interruption of their service
so there could be some upgrade to their service. And the upgrade to their service, it turned out, was not putting a new line on the wooden pole or making some other change. It was putting this metal tower with a cell phone component and then this piece buried next to it that everyone on the street claimed caused them some hardship because of whatever it was emitting. And again, I don't know enough about the technology. So I just, now I'm pleased to hear you from what you earlier said was that this is going to be addressed in these rules. But that's what triggered my interest. And you and I were at the same meeting when we had folks as far as two blocks from this particular site claiming that they'd been impacted by the radio waves or whatever was emitted from that transponder.
Okay. Go ahead and resume your presentation.
Needless to say, we learned a lot from this poll. That is correct. But the notice issue is key. There's currently no notice required. And the notice that PGE gave in this particular instance was unrelated. It's under the OPUC regs that if you're going to cut power to someone's home, you must provide notice. And that's a safety issue. If people are on medical life-saving equipment, they have to know. They have to have opportunity. The pole immediately to the right of this, PGE did replace a transformer. They can only do that by cutting power. So that notice and the notice and the notice for this pole are really two separate issues.
So that was just coincidental?
Let's go.
Yes. So let me proceed if I could. Sorry. So then we worked with the power company, the wireless company, and the neighbors, and this pole now looks like this, which is, again, you might remember back to the canister antenna at 39th and Burnside, very, very similar. And you know, it's also this, painted.
Okay, so that's a metal pole painted.
This is still metal.
With a new top.
Right, with a new antenna. So here's an example of same power company, same wireless company, same steel pole, almost the exact same height of a replacement pole, also in a residential area, also on a residential street, across the street from homes. This went in after the Wilburn Deacon pole, and staff with the city heard zero complaints. So no calls, no emails, no meetings.
Is there anything buried next to it akin to what was at the Arbor Lodge?
Yes, there is.
The what you described as the cooler and the...
If you look closely, you can see white cement of new cement in the sidewalk there in two places, one in the foreground and one right more or less adjacent to the pole. And yes, there's vaults underneath.
Is that a park or school?
That is a church.
It's a church. So nobody lives in front of this.
Well, there's a home
across the sidewalk.
Well,
it's
to the left.
It's a church.
Correct.
And is that a metal pole painted?
Yes, it is. Okay. So this last slide is a pole that was replaced on Boone's Ferry in Stevenson, and I used it to demonstrate another requirement that we have. And that is that if a street tree can be planted, there's city regulations about where and when you can plant them, and there are National Electrical Safety Code regs as well. But if those can be met, then we're going to require that the carrier plant a street tree if it can be planted such that all or most of the pole can be obscured by the mature canopy. So this was our goal through this process. It's to provide a clear, non-discretionary permit process that allows wireless antenna on utility poles, yet responds to the neighborhood concerns about aesthetics and eliminates or minimizes the visual or other impacts. That was staff's goal throughout this process. And here are the legal constraints, as Ben already mentioned. They have a legal right, they, meaning the wireless carriers, have a legal right to place their attachments on utility poles. And so, What are the changes? And here they are. In a single-family residential area where the primary issue has been, first of all, we're going to ask that the carrier demonstrate and certify that they've looked to use any other structure if possible. And I believe handed out to you is this yellow sheet. This is an application that the wireless carriers are going to have to submit with any future wireless application for an antenna in the right-of-way. And they first need to certify that they have tried to use any other building or structure, including like a water tank or an adjacent or abutting cell tower, anything, before they've looked to the streets. Then when they use the streets, we ask that they look to the most non-residential streets first. I'm sorry, for zoning. We go through the zoning And so, it's, as you can see, they need to look at industrial first, employment second, commercial third, and so on, and single-family residential is last. Then, even if they still have to be in a single-family residential area or not, you turn it over, and you can see they have to go